Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life in Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this.
This year, Northumberland Hills Hospital had a $1.1 million surplus. It was slightly more than the previous year's surplus of $800,000. With all the pressures on the healthcare system locally and across Ontario, how is that possible? The CEO and Chief of Staff at Northumberland Hills Hospital will explain what's been going on over the past year. The hospital's annual report was recently released. This conversation will cover everything from doctor recruitment to mental health services, along with everything in between. You will also get a response to a report released by the Canadian Institute for Health Information. It tracks national trends on healthcare. The report says 1.5 million people spent more than 14 hours in emergency rooms across the country. That is nearly a one-third increase over a five-year period. So what about locally? You will want to hear the answer to that question as well.
I'm so pleased to have with me today Northumberland Hills Hospital President and CEO Susan Walsh and Chief of Staff Dr. Paul Kitoff. Welcome to you both to Consider This Northumberland.
Good morning, Rob. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Susan, this year the hospital had a $1.1 million surplus, slightly more than the previous year's surplus of $800,000. With everything going on in the healthcare sector and the demands on local services, how did you end up being in the black?
It's a really great question, Rob. I think that this year we were really fortunate to, as we were planning the year, we started the year not looking that strong in terms of our actual budget. And so through efforts that we did internally, we were able to find internal savings, but we also did receive a couple of one-time funding, pressure funding to support the hospital based on the volumes that we're seeing. So from time to time, organizations will receive what's called pressure funding, and it's really to support, you know, those beds that you have open that are not funded, increased volumes. And so we did, in fact, do two things. We had two one-time pressure fundings, and we also did work internally to manage our expenses.
Can you talk a little bit more about the additional funding from the province? Why is that important, and why is it not part of your overall allotment that you get annually to keep going?
So when you look, I was actually just looking at our figures. So when I became CEO in 2021, our revenues were approximately just over $80,000. In our last year, the last fiscal year, 25-26, our revenues are now over $140,000. And so that's been a combination of base funding, new programs, and continued pressure funding. And so usually there's a lag between when you get base funding rolled into your budget versus when you get pressure funding. So you may get pressure funding for a couple of years, and then based on performance, you then may see that converted into base funding. I would say that if you look across the sector right now, the projected deficit after the budget was released by the province is $1.5 billion across the province. So there's a lot of pressures on healthcare right now in terms of financial sustainability, and some good investments that are being made in other areas such as primary care and home care. However, the challenges of the day continue. So I don't have a very, it's not a formulaic answer. We really do not know from year to year what pressure funding we will get. And so we just, you know, we are very grateful for the funding that we do receive. And as I said, this year we did receive two tranches of pressure funding, which allowed us to balance.
Susan, I believe you meant 140 million, not 1,000.
Oh, did I say 1,000? Sorry. Yes, 140 million. Yes.
Say that again.
When I first started speaking, I said that we, in 2021, we were just over 83 million as an organization in revenues. And this past year, it was 140 million. I think I said 140,000. So Paul was just correcting it. A few extra zeros were missing.
Significant ones, too. I'd like to talk about then the savings. You mentioned that you found some savings. Where were those areas that you found the savings? And did it alter any services that you provide?
No, we didn't make any changes to services. In fact, we grew services last year. So we continue to invest in the areas that we needed to. So what we do is we have access to benchmarking information that tells us, relative to other organizations of the same size, how are you doing? And so we identified a number of different areas. There are things that we looked at. So we looked at our sick time, overtime, and we did a lot of work on supply chain. So we really tried to delve into all of our contracts, making sure that we were managing our supplies appropriately. And we always do, but there's always opportunities. And so we targeted a number of different areas and were able to save a substantial amount of money, really, in terms of that.
In the annual report, 21% of the operating revenue, or about $30 million, comes from patient and other revenues. In Canada, we're supposed to have a universal healthcare system. Can you break this area of revenue down for us to better understand what people are paying for that's not covered?
Yeah, and I think that the language sometimes gets confusing because we also report physician flow-through funding that goes through patient and other revenue. So in the hospital right now, the only things that patients are paying for is parking. We have some payments that come through for accommodation, which is based on very prescribed practices around whether people have insurance for private pay, semi-private, or ward coverage. So that would generate some revenues. But the other revenues, the revenues and other, also comes through flow through. So any money that is paid to physicians as part of their contract with the OMA comes through patient revenues, and it's just the way it's called, and sometimes it's confusing, but it isn't actually patients paying for things.
So what are you going to do with this surplus?
Well, the 1.1 million is an acceptable surplus that we can then use to support our books, our balance sheet, really, because even though you may have a surplus in your books, you also, you know, working capital for hospitals has been very challenging. So the working capital challenges across the system are significant right now. So this 1.1 million, based on, it's 1% of our revenues, it's less than 1% of our revenues, it will just sit on our balance sheet.
Paul, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. The Canadian Institute for Health Information, which tracks national trends in healthcare, just released last week a report saying 1.5 million people spent more than 14 hours in emergency rooms, nearly one-third increase over a five-year period. What is the average wait time in the emergency room at NHH?
It really depends on what we consider average wait time. So the way that both the Kaiha Institute that you've mentioned, as well as how we track things internally, is the visit is broken down into sections. So, you know, we track the amount of time that a patient waits until they see a physician. And then after that, we track total length of stay. But it's separated into total length of stay for patients that are discharged, ultimately, after their tests or investigations, or that are admitted. So it's actually quite hard to put a number on it, because it's not going to be representative of a patient that's going to be admitted versus patients going to be discharged. The other thing that we do at NHH to try to sort of balance some of that some of that reporting and some of that some of those numbers with actual patient care is the ministry and the CAHI specifically track the amount of time until a physician assesses a patient. However, given that we do have solo coverage certain hours of the day, and it does get quite busy, every patient that comes through the emergency department when they speak with a triage nurse is actually risk stratified into how acute their presentation may be, any tests that they're done based on the nurse choosing some of the tests that we've all agreed on. For example, you know, you do heart tests if you come with chest pain. A physician sees that heart tracing that gets done and triage immediately within 5 minutes usually. Any tests that are abnormal or any tests that are concerning are usually seen by a physician immediately. Now, we may not have said hi to the patient, which is why it doesn't qualify for that assessment time, but we're all aware of all the patients that are present in the waiting room as well as inside the department. So sometimes it's hard for a medium-sized hospital like ourselves to sort of use those numbers to represent the patient experience. The patient experience really is going to be that if they're sick, they'll be walked in right away. If they're not acutely unwell right now, the tests that they're going to have done are going to be seen by a physician, especially if they're abnormal or anything that time sensitive, such as strokes or heart attacks, are going to be addressed right away. But there are times where patients might wait, you know, 4 hours plus to see a physician for them to come and say hi to them. Now, again, in our system, what we oftentimes will often do is because those medical directives have been activated, meaning the nurse has activated the orders that we typically would ask for, when we see our patients, a lot of times we kind of have everything already ready. And so we might come and say, this is what your blood work shows, this is what your heart tracing shows. And many of our patients are discharged after the initial visit. The other part of that is the total length of stay also includes things like waiting for imaging, making sure the imaging gets done correctly, making sure that we're balancing both emergency room patients alongside with inpatients. And it sort of, it, you know, the patient experience is really not waiting hours and hours to see, to get tests done. It's sometimes waiting hours and hours or a couple of hours to see a physician to review the tests that have already been done.
I really appreciate the answer, and it's very in-depth. But at the same time, how do we measure wait times and in a way that can be meaningful for people to understand just how effective our emergency room is and how it compares to the rest of the country? Could somebody shed some light on that?
I'll say one thing before I answer that question, Rob, is that you actually, in Paul is an emergency physician. So he knows this. He was the former chief of our ED. So he's very familiar with this. But I would say more broadly is that the emergency department is a barometer for the whole healthcare system. So when I think about, you know, what's happening in primary care, when people are not seeing, having access to physicians, then they may come to the emergency department. So whatever's happening in primary care impacts the emergency department. Also, what's happening in home care and community care also affects the emergency department, because the emergency department is a place you come or go, or you come and you flow into the hospital. And so if you are not able to discharge a patient safely, then we fill up on our beds, and then people sit in the emergency department to wait to be admitted. And that's the data that I think was being highlighted in the report, in terms on average, some people sit for 48 hours, but it's an average. And so we live in data full of averages. And so in those averages, you've got the individuals who come and go very quickly and those individuals that stay. I would truly say that when you look at the state of the emergency departments across Ontario right now, what you're seeing really is a barometer for the whole healthcare system. And I do believe that we're making progress in terms of some of the investments that are being made in primary care with the IPCT funding, which is the interprofessional primary care funding for the teams. That will start to have an impact on the number of people that come, but it will not impact those individuals who are aging and staying at home with multiple comorbid conditions. So they have more than one chronic disease that they're living with. And so Paul and I were having this conversation in our meeting last week around, you know, emergency department wait times. And we were talking about, you know, this year was the first time that we saw our volumes go down slightly. And so we were talking about, what do we think is driving those volumes for this year? Because we were one of the only hospitals where our volumes actually increased after COVID. And Paul was sharing with me that, you know, we may see a slightly lower volumes, but the people that we're seeing, they're actually sicker. And so they take more time. They have to be, you know, they may be elderly. When we were doing our master planning, the greater than 85-year-olds are going to triple in the next 40 years within this region. And so you know that individuals coming to the emergency department need people to speak slowly to them. They need, to have explanations about what's going on. And if they need to be admitted, then the other part of the system, which is, can you get flow, alternate level of care, so patients can get home if they're waiting for long-term care. So it's as I said, it's a barometer for the system. And I know that I said a lot right then, but I was trying to paint a picture that it's not one size fits all. And it truly, the averages don't always tell the story.
So then how does the community have a yardstick at which it can look at the hospital and say, compared to the rest of the system, here's where we're sitting at? And I look through the report and I really don't see anything that allows us to make that apples to apples comparison. And while both of you have given very rational and very understandable answers, and I do appreciate mm-hmm. both what you said, for the average individual listening to this, it seems like a lot of words, and yet we don't know, if I'm going to go in there, am I going to be waiting a long time or am I not? And how does that compare to everywhere else? Am I getting good service?
I'll give my answer, and then I'll let Paul give his answer. I would say that first and foremost, we are very, if you come into the emergency department and you are sick, meaning you need urgent care, you will be taken care of in as toot sweet. You will be taken care of right away. So I can put my hand on my heart and fully say that I know that there are ways in which if you are sick or even mildly sick or a little bit sick, based on your level of need, you will have tests done, you will be seen, and you will be treated accordingly. Sometimes when individuals come and they may need support, but they don't need that really hands-on intense care, they may sit longer because somebody else is being cared for. And that is always the juggle. I will also say that externally, we are heavily monitored around emergency wait times, and the targets that we receive as a hospital that are paid to funding actually are being driven further, lower and lower every year, because the expectation is that we're driving that down. So from my perspective, the only thing that I can say is, if you are an individual that needs care and you call an ambulance or you drive in and you are sick, you will get care in a timely fashion. Paul, I'll toss it over to you as the person who receives these individuals.
No, I think you said it well, Susan. I think the challenging thing, Robert, like you're saying, is from an individual perspective coming in, statistics are statistics, right? They look at averages, they look at 90th percentiles, which is what we oftentimes submit in terms of our data to the Institute. 90th percentile is the worst case scenario. If you come into the emergency department, I absolutely agree. I put my hand to my heart that if you come to the emergency department and you need urgent care, within the next 20 minutes, within the next 5 minutes, you will receive that timely care. If you come in the hospital and you are stable, but you are sick and require an admission and require resuscitation or other things, so things that need to be done to stabilize things, you will receive that care the same time, if not faster, than other hospitals of our size and around our area. I think the challenging thing a lot of time becomes, if you look at averages and you have people who are seen within 10 minutes and people who may wait 4 to 5 hours to be seen, that average is then not really representative of patients' experience. I think, what our patients, what our community needs to know, if they come into an NHH emergency department, they will receive the care that they need. If they happen to wait a little bit longer, that's because we're being more thorough, because we're waiting for those tests to come back, and perhaps we need some time to get to. So we can also sit down with you and explain them. We do also track other statistics in terms of complexity, right? So complexity is very difficult to represent in a numerical format. But we look at our number of admissions, that's raised every year, over a year. When we look at our age of admissions or age of our patients that are admitted, that's right, that goes up year over year. And so just like what Susan has mentioned, sometimes it does require more time. And I would like to provide that time. I don't really believe in medicine that's fast for the sake of statistics, but forgets about the patient experience and really taking your time with each patient. And I can speak for the entire emergency department that I feel they all feel the same.
Have there been several provincial initiatives to provide relief to hospitals where For example, pharmacists are taking a larger role in prescribing certain medications, and there's been an increase in the number of walk-in clinics locally, as well as telehealth opportunities. Can you tie the drop in statistics for the number of people that you've been serving back to policy initiatives by the province or local contributions? Are these things having an impact that's taking off some pressures from the hospital?
I think they are in some level. Right. So when we look at that, the drop in our total volumes this year, a part of that surely represents, you know, the walk-in clinics that have been open the last within the last 12 months in the community. And I'm sure it represents a lot of the telehealth and outreach programs that have been started. However, the challenging thing for some of these programs is they really address presentations that are either one, don't only have sort of one problem, right, or a relatively simple. If you have a young, healthy person who comes in with symptoms of a bladder infection that does not require blood work and investigations, it's a lot easier to assess them in the community, in the pharmacy setting where you may not have access to labs, or in the community where you have access to labs but not labs in the next couple of hours. However, if you have a complex individual who now has a fever and other symptoms, a lot of times they'll get redirected to the emergency department. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing less of those simpler visits. However, we're at the same time in our community are seeing a higher average number of more complex individuals. And so that drives our complexity up, which in fact drives our wait times up. So they've helped. However, on a, you mentioned, you know, an average person who's thinking about coming into the hospital, it does mean that if somebody's more complex, requires more workup, a lot of times they're still ending up in the emergency department because that's where they need to be to have some of those time-sensitive tests done.
I also noticed, Paul, in the report that there was a two-year trend where there's been some drop in services in areas like surgical cases, but there's a lot of others that are trending upward. What does this tell you?
Well, when I look at our report and I look at the stats, you know, I think the surgical cases drop of, you know, 1.7% is really just a variation. A lot of times we'll have some variation depending on what kind of surgeries that we're providing. We've in fact only grown our surgical services, but if, again, if you look at total numbers, some things may fluctuate year over year. But when I look at those almost double-digit numbers increases in terms of services that are needing, such as, you know, ambulatory care clinic visits, which is where surgeons also work out of in addition to their offices, you know, the amount of diagnostic imaging, which will often indicate how much each individual person needs in terms of workup and in terms of their treatment and their stay in the hospital, and our total admissions go up by 10% over the last 2 years. Really what it tells me, I don't think that the drop in surgical services is that significant, but what it tells me is that the complexity of our patients, the general needs, and the general admission volumes are higher.
Susan, over the two-year period, there was a drop in the number of people using community mental health. And when you consider the number of times people talk about the need for mental health services in our community, can you help us understand what's going on there?
Yeah, we had a lot of conversations around that number because it didn't actually feel that it represented the work that we're doing. And I know that the team that were pulling the data, there were some changes in a system. And so I would say that that number itself is the best estimate that we have of what those volumes were, but there may be some visits that were not captured. I know that as we were preparing for the report, because we've seen an increase, we've expanded our community mental health. So it's a data that may have some artifacts in it slightly, but it's representative of the total volume.
Is it a reason to say that maybe we need more mental health services? I'm just thinking that issues of mental health are often associated with unsheltered people living in Northumberland. And with the drop in service levels, is there any capacity for community mental health to be doing more to support unsheltered people or others in the community?
Yeah, our community mental health team work very close with our community partners in this space because we obviously have a number of our programs that do support individuals in the community who may be living at risk. I would say that when we went through our master planning community consultations, mental health services was one of the areas that we heard was a desire for us to do more in terms of access to inpatient mental health beds. So in our master plan that we're submitting to the ministry, which is just the early stages, for the pre-capital submission, we have included access to mental health beds in our hospital so that we're no longer having to transfer to our regional center. And so that will bring with it increased services, increased access, as well as we will be able to provide greater space for programs in mental health space. So definitely one of the areas that we heard we need more services in that regard. So I would agree with you.
Susan, also, in the report, there is a reference to uncertainties. In fact, the word comes up quite a number of times. What are you alluding to when you talk about the uncertainty?
I think that overall, the past year, just to put this into context, it's been an incredible year for the hospital. We have had so many growth in new programs that I think speaks to our desire to continue to meet the needs of this community. But what is uncertain is really what the impact of population growth will have on this region. We know that there's a new nuclear site that's being proposed in Wesleyville, and we are really trying to understand the impact on the population in the growth phase of that, in the build phase of that project, but also in the ongoing maintenance phase of that. So that's an area of uncertainty. I would say from a funding perspective, there's also uncertainty from a financial perspective. The healthcare system is under pressure. And so, you know, as much as there are requirements for acute care investments, there are also requirements for investments in primary care, which you're seeing now being really seriously invested in by the government. But there are also investments required in home and community care so that individuals can be living at home as long as they can. And I would also say that there's uncertainty around the impact of cybersecurity on hospitals. We are very much a target for bad actors in the system who really want to impact organizations that provide vulnerable services because we're a target. So there's many different areas that we balance every day to day. And the last area I would say is health human resources. As a medium-sized hospital, we have more challenges to attract specialists to this region to support those needs of services than other areas. And it's a known fact, medium-sized hospitals, because of our, where we're located, usually in a community, don't have access to some of the physician funding programs that are the benefit of downtown teaching academic organizations, and also just health human resources in general. Nurses, physicians, OT, PTs, everyone who services a hospital there's many different hospitals around who can provide that same employment opportunity. So that's four that I can think of from the top of my head.
I would add to that, if you don't mind, Robert, you know, I think the everything that Susan said, I certainly agree with. But I also sometimes think uncertainty is not always such a bad thing, right? You know, in medicine, we learn to live with uncertainty, just like we do in our regular lives. I'll give you, and I think that our hospital, as a hospital, our job is not only to plan ahead and try to build resources as the community grows, but also to service the community that we currently serve and be able to be agile and fit what the community needs. So I'll give you an example. We've just talked about, you know, age of admissions and complexity, but then last year we've opened up our new neonatal and perinatal clinic, which is the exact opposite spectrum of human experience. However, you know, we saw the need and we saw that our community needs it, and the hospital made a concerted effort to put that service together to service a population that we need to service. So a little bit of uncertainty is not a bad thing, but certainly what Susan is referring to, I agree with.
How would you characterize, though, Paul, the staffing? Are there enough doctors and are there enough nurses? Are there enough people there to get the job done?
Can always use more. Yes, I think there are. You know, it's I can speak to the physician part. You know, the physician staffing is stable. However, the challenges that we oftentimes find ourselves are some of those things that are more subspecialized, right? So trying to get some specialists or specialists to come out to our hospital. Many people are not at the point where they want to move a little bit further outside the city because they have other reasons to be closer to the city. And so they're willing to travel, but sometimes it's not the same level of specialist care that an academic hospital might benefit. However, I do think that all of our physicians are extremely dedicated, and they really care about the patients they see, and they follow up on them, and they make sure that things are done correctly. And I think that's good. From a staffing perspective, we are keeping up with the growth right now. What I worry about long term is things like retirements and our partners in the community. And we work very closely with our community teams and our family physician teams. We find that we are needing to upstaff more to make up for one retirement, for example, just because of size of practices. And I think we always want to be a little bit of ahead, just one step ahead in terms of our staffing, so we have a little bit of buffering. I do think we're stable. We just need to work on it.
Sorry, Susan.
Yes.
In particular, nurses. I know in the past you and I have talked about this topic, and there was a point where the hospital was having to bring in contract nurses to cover off things. Can you update us on the status?
Yeah, we're actually mostly agency free. So we're in the organization now. The only area where we've been using agency and it is targeted by September to be completely eradicated is in our ICU. We recently upgraded our ICU to become a level 3 basic ICU, so a higher level of acuity. And so as we were ramping up and getting more staff trained in critical care, we were using agency, but across the organization now, we're not using agency. We did have a short stint of ultrasound support, but that's finished. And so our agency nursing will be completely gone, I think, by September of this year.
Paul, one of the things that needs to be distinguished is doctor recruitment. So there's efforts to bring doctors, family physicians into the community, but that's different than the doctors that serve at the hospital. Can you bring us up to date on what's going on with recruitment around physicians for the hospital as compared to what's going on within the community at large?
Well, recruitment for physicians at the hospital is a main priority for me. In fact, that's been the highest focus over the last 12 months for my office. We've worked really hard to try to bring folks on board, and we have seen lots of success with bringing folks on board that are joining our acute services, so hospitalists and ICU. We've had emergency room recruitment. We're still having needs for emergency rooms, so we're continuing to recruit. We've also been able to upstaff and try to make up for adjusting coverage. So, if you have two doctors covering a service, but we need a third, sometimes we need to bring in a third, even though the coverage is the same, to try to make sure that I think we're providing the same level of service, but the physicians are hanging around a little bit longer. From a recruitment perspective, that is definitely a priority. We've recruited in almost every single area this year. I still think we need to do more. My opinion is that the forward way or the future direction of this needs to be an increase in how many residents and trainees come to our hospital. That's what I've been focusing on. So reaching out to every resident that comes through and trying to see if we can retain them once they're done their training. Because once they've had exposure to the hospital, many of them do want to stay because they kind of see that the community aspect of the county at large and of the hospital itself. But we have to get them here so they can actually see what it's like. So then I can make them hang around.
Susan, this year there was a $13 million that was spent on capital acquisitions or buying things and services. Can you break this down for us?
Yes. So this year, as you are aware, the foundation had a major capital campaign over the last few years. We have many pieces of equipment that have been in place since the hospital was first opened in 2003. So this year, we actually invested in a new SPECT CT, a new MRI. We also are also opening a new operating room to be able to bring more surgeries closer to home and be a system asset. We also did some renovations in our pharmacy to ensure that we are up to NAPRA. It's called NAPRA compliance, which is basically compounding of non-sterile drugs. And so it needs specific equipment to do that. And also we did some renovations within the lab as well. And in our medical devices reprocessing unit. So all of those things were our major capital campaigns that got broken down into a number of different ways. So not only were we introducing new programs such as the NHH at Home, the newborn clinic and perinatal clinic that Paul spoke about, the stroke recovery clinic. We also advanced our level ICU. We also had major projects going on, probably the largest projects that the hospital has seen in 20 years. And so it was a really, really busy year. And I know everyone was saying, enough, we've got too many things going on. But we're driven by this desire to make sure that we are moving forward and being able to keep up with the technology and the demand so that we can service our community. So we're very grateful for our community for all their support through the work of the foundation.
Just to follow that up, partnerships are always a vital part of NHH. What institutions and agencies are you working with right now to achieve overall goals?
So many. So we are, as you know, Rob, we're part of the Ontario Health Team of Northumberland. So all of the partners that are within the OHT are partners that we regularly partner with. So, you know, many of those, you've spoken to them, Rebound, the Northumberland Family Health Team, the Community Health Centers of Northumberland, and many, many more, and Alderville. We also have partners with our five hospitals within the region. So we work very closely with PRHC, Ross, Campbellford, Triple HS, so Halliburton Highlands, and have I missed one? There's five of us. We meet every Friday as CEOs to talk about planning for the region. So we are very, we have lots of partners that we work with. We're actually right now partnering with Alderville in its early stages, but we're working on a patient navigation system and that we're having an Indigenous patient navigator. So we're doing a co-design model. And I think that Jennifer is doing a lot of work in that space, would be a great conversation in the future. We really are in the early stages of that work. And so we see ourselves very much as a partner within the system. Healthcare is a system and we're connected in so many ways, as I said at the very beginning. So I haven't listed all the partners, but I know we have a lot.
Paul, if I was to give you a magic wand and you were to wave it away and make a wish, what would that be for going forward? What do you see as being necessary or needed in the next year, in the next couple of years, in order to continue to provide service?
I think I'd really base that answer on our master planning. I mean, the whole purpose of master planning is not only submitting what we think we need for growth of the hospital and maintaining the service of the community, but also, you know, part of master planning is consultation. So when we went around and consulted our partners, our external partners, our patients, as well as our staff and currently working physicians and nurses, you know, we see what they've asked for. So I would really have our master plan sort of wished in place, where we would have expansion of services in mental health beds. We would have some growth in terms of having generally areas where we can provide better or more focused services, more subspecialists, and expansion of consultations, you know, trying to bring subspecialists here so they can do consults and they can hopefully stick around and provide service as we grow.
Susan, I'm now giving you the magic wand.
I know. I was going to say thank you for that. I was looking forward to having the magic wand. You know, Paul, I really appreciated what you said about the master planning, because we asked three questions when we went through the master planning. We said, what do you appreciate about NHH today? What's missing from what we provide? And what do you see as being what's happening in the community? And we spoke with we got 420 different touch points. We spoke with our politicians. We spoke with our real estate agents, everyone, just to give us a sense of what's happening in this community that we should be aware of. But if I truly had a magic wand, I would really want that every single person, this is a bit idealistic, but I really do truly believe this, that every single person within our community has access to the right care at the right time with the right touch and by the right provider, so that, you know, because as a system and as a society, we really are all about what we call our shared purpose, which is people first. And so whatever we do, we're doing it for the people of this community, for the people who work here, live here. That would be my magic wand.
Susan Walsh, Dr. Paul Kitoff, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you for that.
That was Northumberland Hills Hospital President and CEO Susan Walsh and Chief of Staff Dr. Paul Kitoff. I want to thank my guests this week for talking to me, and I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in today.
Please join me again next week when we will talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So please tune in. If you would like to listen or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you will find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening and stay tuned for more from Consider This.